Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this week's show is brought to you by Gigamon. Gigamon makes an NDR product, a network detection and response product. Gigamon's NDR was Iceberg, but since that acquisition, development has obviously continued. We'll be joined a little bit later on by Gigamon's security product manager, Fayaz Rajpari, to talk about some of the latest stuff they've been working on. That is this week's sponsor interview. It's an interesting chat. Even though they're an NDR vendor, they've been working on stuff like integrations via the CrowdStrike API. So this is evidence of more of that convergence between EDR and NDR. We're a long way from having a single pane of glass for everything, but we are seeing more and more useful integrations. So fewer panes of glass, I guess, or maybe better multiple panes of glass. Anyway, that is coming up later. But first up, let's get into the news with Adam Boileau, the week's InfoSec news. And Adam, I guess we'll start off by just capturing the vibe of the week.
There has been a lot of flailing and screaming this week. Many people throwing their arms in the air.
Yes. I guess the one that made the biggest splash this week is that Citizen Lab apparently caught a iOS zero day. Well, not just iOS. Apparently, it affected all Apple software and, you know, basically every device hardware ever made. Pretty sweet bug. They're saying it was used by NSO to target a bunch of activists and whatnot. But that resulted in an emergency patch and just a big old freak out on the interwebs.
Yeah, there's been a lot of headlines and, you know, kind of more mainstream media coverage of this one than average. There's been people sort of drawing conclusions from that in terms of there being a whole bunch more zero day around, or it being more important, or, you know, that people are perhaps more connected with the need to patch their stuff. But it's hard not to look at it, you know, from our perspective. You and I have been, you know, covering this stuff for a long time ago. This just feels like another day in the office, for zero day. And things getting owned and stuff getting patched.
Yeah, I mean, I posted a tweet after, you know, amidst all of this, and I said, you know, if you were a target yesterday, you're still a target today, and NSO can just pull another trick off the shelf to own you with, right? But, that said, I patched this one quickly because someone else might figure it out and ransomware my phone or something, right? So still a good idea to patch quickly, but everyone's like, when you're seeing people who are sort of, yeah, outside the sphere saying you must patch your phone immediately, it just sort of feels a bit weird.
It does, right? And I mean, you're right, there is certainly a legit concern that, you know, someone's going to reverse engineer the patch. You know, a lot of things have been owned, you know, in that kind of patch gap by reverse engineering. And, you know, certainly when we were at Immunity, patch Tuesday, you know, reversing Wednesday was what came next, so that you could pull it out and get some exploits rolling before anyone managed to hit the ground with their patching. And so it does change the risk profile. But I mean, for me, you know, I woke up in the morning, there's a new iOS patch. Okay, yeah, should probably apply it. But the Chrome bugs that got patched kind of worried me more than the iOS bugs.
Before we get to them, I should point out that in reply to that tweet that I mentioned, Shane Huntley, who runs Google Tag, actually replied, and he said something interesting. He said, let's not jump to the conclusion that NSO have an endless supply of zero-click exploits and there's nothing that can be done. Security nihilism and learned helplessness plays into attackers' hands. We can make progress here. And I think he does make a good point, right, which is burning this kind of O-Day hurts companies like NSO more than it used to, right? I think that is something that we can safely say, is it's getting so much harder to find these types of bugs that when you burn them, they're going to feel that a little bit more than they would have 5 years ago.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, the cost of those kinds of bugs, the difficulty replacing them, yeah, I mean, it is expensive compared to, you know, if we burnt a, you know, Woo FTPD bug in the mid 90s, late 2000s. Like, yeah, that's not that's not really worth anything. Whereas, yeah, zero click iMessage, you know, or Apple image parsing bugs, like that's a, you know, a real hurt for them. And yeah, I'm sure they don't have an infinite number of them on the shelves. They probably got enough, which is what matters. And certainly if you look at the history of like Apple's patches this year, I think they've patched what, 10? That were used, 10 zero day that were used in the wild, according to Google's, you know, Google Tags tracking of that, which is, you know, that's more than one a month on average.
Yeah.
And so the fact that these ones are special and warranted extra, you know, flailing, I don't know that that's the case, but, you know, the fact that we are looking for and finding them being used in the wild, that, you know, that there's people like Citizen Lab, you know, that not only burns the bugs, but it also, you know, if you're selling that capability to the Saudis as NSO, or you're the Saudis using that capability, right, that does change your calculus, that you're going to get one, you know, maybe only one shot at this, you know, however much that particular bug ended up costing to dev and then and buy and all that kind of thing. Like, that also changes the rest of the calculus, like not just the technical bug finding part of it.
Yeah, and it's not just Citizen Lab. I mean, Google Tag as well, and organizations like that. I mean, they're spending a lot of time looking for this stuff actually out there on the internet. So I think, you know, these companies, not that I want to give them free advice, but, you know, they're going to have to work a little bit harder to constrain the delivery of these exploits to the actual intended targets, right?
And also the, you know, when you use the same techniques and same tooling on multiple targets and people like Tag have a copy of the internet to go search, being able to work backwards once eventually it gets snapped, right? It just adds a whole bunch of complexity to your operational planning if you're trying to be deniable and, you know, keep your capabilities secret and what you're doing secret. So, yeah, I mean, whilst the bugs, whilst there's plenty of bugs to be found, the other operational concerns are kind of also very expensive. You know, whilst you and I can bug nihilism about it, like even if that was still, even if that was 100% legitimate position that there's always going to be more bugs, the operational concerns, I think, probably are bigger.
Yeah, no, fair point. But yeah, look, you mentioned those Chrome bugs earlier, and yeah, they're pretty bad as well.
Yeah,
and they're being used in the wild, being exploited in the wild.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, obviously, bugs in Chrome potentially also have, you know, similar impacts in other Chrome browsers. So, you know, even if the bugs get patched in one place, reverse engineered, and then, you know, their applicability checked against other browsers, they're, you know, in a way, those concern me more because, you know, there's more Chromium browsers out there than there are iPhones. And given how everything's, you know, everything's browser based and everyone's clouds are admin by people in browsers, and, you know, those bugs worry me more than iOS. I mean, iOS one's sure, you know, giving the phone is bad, but getting in the browser, you know, you've got a lot of options.
Yes, you do. And something like 66 this year, something like 66 like ODAs have popped up being exploited in the wild, right? And we were kicking this around internally, just having this discussion, because it's hard to know whether that's a meaningful metric, right? On one hand, it's like, wow, that's a lot of ODAs. But on the other hand, it's like, well, maybe we're just better at spotting this stuff actually in the wild these days, whereas previously there was just as much of it, but you didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the absolute numbers are always difficult to work with when the whole ecosystem is changing around you. Like, if you say how many 0 days per year have there been, you know, over the last 20 years, even if you had perfect visibility of that, the amount of software in the world has changed, you know, and, you know, kind of deriving metrics is just really, really difficult. And I think, you know, there is a little bit of all of the options, right? I mean, we are clearly better at spotting 0 day in the wild. There's clearly more need to use 0 day in the wild. I mean, in the old days, you know, there were so many, like you could hit everybody with ancient Acrobat bugs and still get everywhere that you needed to go. You didn't need so much 0 day or as flash or whatever else. I mean, so more ODA in the wild, we're better at spotting it. There's more need to use it. You know, we're also getting better at knowing where to look for it, I think. You know, you don't have to go look for ODA on every ransomware gig. You only have to go look for it on, you know, activists and people who are, you know, targeted by the Chinese government or whatever else. So we know better where to look, but, you know, you think about what percentage of intrusions are misconfiguration or didn't require bugs, you know, whether they were just password reuse or stuff like that. I mean, so, you know, 0 day is such a small proportion of the amount of hacking that goes on. And every agency that's got access to a stash of ODA, you know, would prefer to use non-zero day bugs everywhere they can, right? You're always going to use the least useful bug that gets the job done just because of the cost and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it's really great that Google are tracking and other people have been tracking, you know, the number of 0 days that are being seen in the wild, because it is a very interesting stat, but it's just such a small part of the puzzle.
Well, and it doesn't tell us all that much trend-wise, right? I mean, because there are just so many factors. It's not as useful a metric as others would have you believe is what we're getting at here. Now, yes, look, speaking exactly. of 0 day in the wild, last week you and I spoke about this god-awful Microsoft Office bug where you could, like, get an ActiveX control to download malware for you via IE and, like, Now, surprise, surprise, very quickly people started using that in the wild.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's, you know, it's a very rich vein of experience with that type of exploitation. So, yeah, turning that into weaponized bugs and seeing it used in the wild by all sorts of people, not at all surprising. I mean, you know, a classic office document bug, everyone wants that. And one that involves IE and ActiveX, that's just, you know, it's like hacker bingo. That's a wonderful thing. You know, you can throw your arms in the air and win a prize.
Yeah, so yeah, that one's apparently being used to target Russian telcos. So that's an interesting one. It's patched now, apparently, but with Microsoft's track record of late with f***ing up their patches, let's just see if they're going to patch it again next week and the week after that before they finally get it right. Now let's talk OMI and Azure, Adam, because...
Oh, Lord.
I know, this is like, I couldn't believe, and this one hasn't really made big news, which kind of surprises me. I, you know, someone sent it to me over Twitter and I just read it and thought, what?
Yep, exactly my experience. I saw there, you know, some people talking about it. I thought, oh, you know, whatever, another, you know, boring. It's like, no, this is a really, wow. I mean, yeah, this is a genuine wow bug. Microsoft deploys a management agent on Linux systems that you spin up inside Azure, and there's a bunch of Microsoft kind of as a service, like higher level services that are built on top of their, you know, like Linux and Azure virtual machines. And so there's a management tool on there called OMI, Open Management Infrastructure, which is an open source, you know, project for doing management, you know, remote management stuff. Anyway, some people went and looked at it and found a local PrivX, several varieties of local, like comedy Unix local PrivX, and also like remote code exec via this thing. Like it has a web, you know, HTTP service listener. And if you just don't send an auth header, it runs the commands that you've asked it to as root on the box.
I mean, that's, you know, as you do, right? As you do. And the best thing about this is, you know, Microsoft are very good at managing this particular secret management code that they put in your Linux instances.
Yes, there is no update mechanism exactly.
But that's okay because they tell all their customers that they're running this stuff, right?
No, they don't. So nearly everybody is not going to know what this is. And certainly if you go Google, you know, the service name and stuff, there's just a bunch of people on forums going, what's this thing that is running a cron job, you know, every minute on my Azure Unix box? Can I turn it off? Like, what's it for? But no, so yeah, you have to self-patch the thing that you don't know exists on your managed cloud service thing that does all the security for you, apparently, according to, you know, what people think about clouds these days. Yeah, wow.
I mean, good job, Microsoft. Good job. And I mean, it's funny, right? Yeah. It's like the Scooby Doo, you know, the pull the mask off the villain, and it's just it's just the same old enterprise we're running it all. I can't imagine this sort of thing popping up. You know, maybe I'm going to have to eat my words, but I can't imagine this same sort of incompetence being present on like AWS. AWS, the risks seem to be that they've just made it too powerful and they give like all of their customers enough rope so that they can hang themselves. Whereas this is just like the same old enterprise crap that was getting you owned in your data center is now getting you owned in Azure.
I mean, sadly, you're correct, right? I mean, AWS has been around for a long time, and I don't know that we've seen anything this dumb out of AWS. I mean, and GCP, I mean, sure, they've had a few bugs with, you know, kind of server-side request forgery and stuff, but, you know, in the cloud plumbing, but this is just... I mean, it's trash. And of course, you made the joke about it being the same enterprise trashware that you ran in your enterprise data center already. Turns out this actually gets shipped with some of the on-prem stuff as well. So like the security Microsoft endpoint for Linux apparently ships this as well. So people are running it in their own data center and ironically in a security product. So, I mean... I know things are cyclical in this industry and Microsoft did go through a phase of getting things better for a while, but...
No, they've gone full on Silicon Valley, move fast, break everything sort of.
Which is fine when you're a small startup, but when you're the, you know, backbone of the entire IT industry of the world and everybody's moving everything into Azure and, you know, any one cross-tenant Azure bug or this kind of thing where you can get, you know, code exec onto a bunch of stuff, you know, in Azure run by customers. Like the impact, imagine if ransomware operators saw this and ransomed every Unix box in Azure at once. that has the service network visible. But can you imagine, you know?
Well, I mean, given that you can't update it, there's still time. Let's see what happens in a few days.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, this other one from Palo, I mean, this is a different issue, right? So this is the crazy thing. There's two really bad Azure things this week to talk about. And it's similar. Yeah. That's the thing. It's actually kind of a similar impact.
Yeah. So, I mean, this research from Palo Alto, and this is really solid work, looks into the Azure Container Infrastructure, which is the kind of like managed Kubernetes container environment that Microsoft provides so that you can run workloads in a, you know, Kubernetes cluster that's managed by Microsoft. And they've made a bunch of relatively smart choices about how that's architected to prevent cross-tenant access, because obviously in a containerized environment, the boundary between tenants is more complicated than in a, you know, like virtualized x86, you know, CPU virtualization sort of structure. Anyway, so this research looks into escaping from the Kubernetes container into the underlying machine that's running it, which, you know, those container runtimes are not generally super intended to be a security boundary. Microsoft thought about that and have allocated, you know, one virtual machine per customer to run the, you know, the container that's being run inside Kubernetes. So that's fine. So they escape from the container runtime using the fact that Microsoft just haven't patched the Kubernetes container runtime for like 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. They used like an off-the-shelf container escape to get up into the, you know, machine that's running it. And then they went looking for the versions of the Kubernetes components that they were running, found similarly out-of-date components, but there were some, you know, kind of reasons why the published bugs didn't work for that as well. But they did some weaseling and eventually got to the point where they could, like, steal a token from one of the Kubernetes management services and then reflect that back to other customer nodes and eventually gain privesc up into the Kubernetes managed Kubernetes runtime. And at that point, they're cross-tenant inside Azure container runtime. And that's
not bad. Really, I mean,
that's as bad as it gets for a cloud service, right? That's as bad as it gets.
It's not really what you want. It's not what you want at all. And this is, you know, the problem is, right, there are real constraints on how much the OFSEC industry can do to kind of unearth these issues, right?
Yes.
Because Microsoft isn't going to just allow everyone to go bananas at their infrastructure and propagate and do creative things because it's a cloud service, right? Even when you're doing a pen test, you know, you can't own Microsoft to test the security of your banking client, right? Like, that's just not something you can do. This is a problem for governments as well, because they can't conduct testing on this sort of infrastructure. So, but just based on what we've been talking about, these last two stories, the research from Palo Alto Networks and the other stuff we should credit as well, that was a company called Wiz that did that. I mean, you just think how much more horrible stuff is behind the curtain that we have no idea about, but that, you know, the good people are constrained in unearthing, but the bad people certainly aren't.
This is the challenge with, you know, running stuff as a service. Like, we intentionally don't want to know how the sausage is made because we're outsourcing the sausage making to the cloud. And that includes the security of this stuff. And you're absolutely right. Like, as in, you know, people doing pen testing and security research and stuff, we're very constrained as to what we can do with cloud services. And, you know, at least some of the big ones, you know, AWS and Azure and so on, like, at least there are bug bounty vulnerability reporting programs so that you know that you can go look to a certain extent. And this Palo Alto research, I looked at it and went, I don't know that I would have done that. Like, that feels on the edge.
I was thinking that as well. Like, how are they not getting sued for this? But I guess, you know, there's PR, there's optics. Palo Alto is a big company, but, you know, they were sailing. I mean, come on, man. They went over the line. They weren't just sailing close to it.
Yeah, like, I think if that was happening in my office and one of my lot was doing that, I'd probably go, maybe we should stop there and let's go make a phone call kind of thing, because that did feel a little close to it. But, you know, we deal with cloud service, you know, when we're trying to help customers do risk assessments and understand their risks when they are moving into these kind of as a service options. You know, there's a whole range of responses that we get, right? We have some vendors that have VIPs and we can go test things. There's some vendors that are like, hell no, no one is allowed to security our test our stuff. You trust us or you don't, you aren't our customer. Those are your two options. Or there's some that have, you know, kind of slightly in the middle, some that will let you have test environment access, but not other stuff. But, you know, being able to introspect software and understand how it works and you know, do vuln research and find bugs, find things that, you know, are undocumented or whatever else, understand the architecture. Like, we are increasingly less able to do this. And I mean, even where some of these service providers do have bug bounty programs, or, you know, kind of vuln reporting programs that allow people to review their security from the outside. Like, I mean, we have an engagement with a customer where they're moving to the cloud and, you know, we are providing some assurance, but we can only do so under the terms of the cloud vendor's vulnerability reporting program, which, if you take it to the letter of the law, means we can't tell our customer about bugs they are paying us to find with their service provider, because that's the terms that we are required to agree to be allowed to be authorized to do, you know, hacking of the cloud service provider. And, you know, if you're a government or you're a, you know, a big customer that can apply some leverage to the, you know, Microsofts or Amazons, then okay, maybe you get to see a bit behind the curtain. But for everybody else, you just got to trust them. And you only got to look at these last two stories.
Well, and yeah, they're running all of this, you know, terrible 1990s style management stuff in the background to make it appear all new and shiny. And it's just
And it's not. And, you know, my experience of looking at the, you know, when we have looked at the innards of cloud service providers is, of course, it's the same software developers, right? It's the same methodologies. It's the same, you know, business pressures to deliver things on time that made all of the, you know, kind of clients, you know, on-prem software bad over the years. All of those things still exist, except now we're doing it faster in one instance where it works for me as the legit, I mean, like, model of the service, and no one can look from the outside. I don't see how that's going to be better, and the impacts are worse. You know, there's some benefits in terms of visibility. You know, Microsoft gets great visibility over their environment, Google gets great visibility, and there are benefits to that. We see the, you know, the speed at which, you know, Google responds to people doing sneaky stuff in their infrastructure, and, I mean, it makes the lives of attackers and pen testers difficult. You know, that's really great. But, I mean, when you look at the complexity of Azure and the sorts of bugs that we're seeing, and
but
the
this is what I mean about Azure being different to AWS and to GCP as well, because you know, AWS is too complicated, so you can hang yourself with it. GCP is too, like, the opposite.
Right? I mean, GCP, like, is too, this is a Google internal thing that we just kind of spewed out for public use.
Exactly, and here's three things you can do with it that it does pretty well, right? Whereas Azure is like, it's like the data center, but it's in the cloud, and we can abstract away a lot of it. But, you know, you look at how they've done that, and look, we speculated for years that eventually someone's going to take a look at this stuff and it's going to be hideous, right? And yes, we're seeing that now. And I just think, based on, like, if this is our first peek behind the curtain, this is a fertile area for research, man. And we're just going to see so much more of this stuff, and hopefully popping up in blog posts instead of data breach notifications and SEC filings.
Well, good luck with that, because such a big target painted on them, and, you know, everyone's going to be looking, and not everyone's going to be there on good terms, you know?
Yeah, so I guess we've been spending a lot of time lately kicking Microsoft, and, you know, this week is no exception, but they've thoroughly earned it. But, you know, don't worry, you can upgrade to an E5 license and get access to all of their products that wouldn't do shit at all to protect you against this stuff. But you can pay them more if that makes you feel good. I guess. Anyway, and it, look, I wonder, because this is, you know, this is like running your own Linux and stuff in Azure. Okay, fair enough. I wonder about, like, you know, the stuff where they've really abstracted it away, where you're basically building, like, Azure native applications. That stuff works really well. Like, I've got friends who've developed very, you know, some pretty advanced stuff, basically serverless. But then you see this stuff and you just wonder, like, what is driving all of this stuff? You know, is it some, like, licensed ancient Oracle Croft behind there, you know? And it's just, they give you this shiny presentation layer. What's behind the curtain? And I've totally lost confidence, man, in Azure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, certainly in the early days of, like, AWS Lambda, you know, people were having a poke around the Lambda runtime environments. And, you know, the same with any of these, kind of, as we go further and further up the stack and more things are managed by the cloud service provider, but we still have the tools and the understanding, you know, with, like, managed databases and managed Kubernetes, right? Where we understand those bits of plumbing, because they're also available elsewhere. We can, you know, go look at them. But when, you know, I'm almost more afraid of the entirely brand new developed in-house ones of those, because at least Kubernetes, we can understand how it works, and the Palo researchers, you know, knew what they needed to do to kind of get around it. But when it's pure whole cloth, internally developed, never seen before, like kind of how Google rolls, then in a way that's almost more scary, because, I mean, once someone steals the source.
We're doing a great job of just making everyone feel great this week. You know, all the listeners are just listening to this going, everything is fine. then we are being a bit nihilistic this week, but, I mean, it's, you know, what choice do we have?
Yeah, it was forced upon us.
Okay, let's shake it off. Let's shake it off with a funny one.
And the great news, the good news story. Here we go. Yes.
Well, a funny news story. VMware is denying, this is according to the Daily Swig, VMware is denying allegations that it leaked a Confluence RCE exploit. This is the one that's been, you know, burning stuff down lately. But you read this story and it looks pretty likely someone at VMware accidentally set a GitHub repo containing said exploit to public. Oops.
Yeah, so this was someone who had had the Confluence bug, I guess, before it was public, has been going around farming bug bounties with it, which, I mean, in a way, and to my mind, is kind of a problem with the bug bounty model. You know, when you got one product bug and then you just go hit every company that uses that product for some tax. Anyway, they had submitted a bug report to VMware about their Confluence, giving them an example exploit that bypassed the specific, or like was specifically dealt with VMware's instance of Confluence. There was some like bypassing the WAF or whatever they had to do that was specific to VMware's instance. Anyway, the exploit for that got leaked, as you say, on a GitHub post, GitHub repo that got made public. And VMware is saying, nah, we totally didn't do it, even though the exploit specifically targets like confluence.eng.vmware.com, which I don't know why else.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, right? Like, and stuff like that happens, and this is the thing, stuff like that happens all the time, and it doesn't make the news, you know? So it's just funny seeing one that actually someone noticed. Look, more big news out of the United States. Three Americans have been fined for breaking U.S. export control laws in working for dark matter in the UAE to own people, to own people's iPhones, etc. Basically, what this does is, and I spoke to Bobby Chesney, who is, of course, from UT Austin and co-founder of Lawfare. I spoke to Bobby about this, and he says basically it means that if you're an American citizen who wants to go and work for an offshore like exploit dev company, you might need a lawyer. Here's what he had to say.
What it means for American citizens who are contemplating a position with an overseas entity is that you'd better get a license. You need to make sure that what you're doing is a licensed activity, or else you've got an Export Controls Act issue. Based on the type of expertise and service you're providing. And you could perhaps distinguish your case from what these guys were doing. Do you want to bet on that? You're going to need a license, and therefore you're going to need a lawyer. On the other hand, even if you've got a license, that doesn't mean anything goes. The DOJ was considering or had on the table Computer Fraud and Abuse Act charges because of the U.S. entities that were hacked. Nothing about the license would have exempted that activity. That would have been prosecutable either way.
So yeah, I mean, if you can get a license to do this sort of work, it doesn't mean you have a license to go and like just hack US companies or individuals with ODAI. but I think this is an interesting turn of events. Now, of course, it was Jenna McLaughlin, I think, who first reported on Project Raven, on the dark matter stuff that was happening in the UAE, and then the Reuters team picked it up and really ran with it. So this is a great result for journalism, I think.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, great example of what was quite technical journalism, you know, and interesting from a geopolitical perspective, now turning into, you know, some interesting precedents being set. And I imagine there's quite a few people that are going to look at this and go, actually, yeah, this is a thing I do need to think about. I mean, the fact that your own brain is now export controlled, you know, under ITAR or whatever, like that's an interesting place to be. But yeah, like if
having your fists registered as deadly weapons, you know?
Yeah, exactly, right? But also, like, if you're, you know, thinking about, you know, going and starting a career in US Gov, US Mil, US Spook, you know, in the cybers, what does this mean for the rest of your career as well, right? I mean, it's an interesting set of trade-offs there. Like, I wonder if this is a recruiting problem now for them, that, you know, once you've finished your time at Fort Meade.
Well, I don't know that it just applies to people who worked in the IC. I mean, it might just as well apply to people like yourself, Adam. You know, if you decided to go and take a job with NSO Group, if you were an American citizen, that might get you in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's also very true, right? It's the fact that we are, you know, regulated weapons. that's a weird time.
You need to get ITAR permission, man. You could be Adam Boileau, licensed to pwn. Now, corporate America is quaking in its boots because, and this is actually quite funny, is like anyone who downloaded that first stage of malware And we mentioned this last week. Please stop writing stories about people who just got that first bit of malware, the poisoned update into their SolarWinds boxes. But now the SEC in America is basically saying, if you downloaded that first stage malware, you now need to disclose to the SEC basically all cyber incidents that have occurred over a, you know, X period of time, which is like got a lot of people going, what, everything? Even the stuff that wasn't the Russian hackers owning us? You mean everything?
No, but honestly, this is amazing. And the SEC is kind of in such a unique position to be able to do this because they have leverage that, you know, other parts of the US government, you know, if they turned up and asked for something, you know, maybe don't have. And
it's corporate regulators actually have power. They don't use it very often, but they do have it.
They do, right? And so this is just really interesting because, I mean, so many people got the SolarWinds first stage and so few people then were subsequently followed up and owned by the Russians. But this net going so wide and so broad in terms of what they're asking for, yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of people quaking in their boots. And actually, one of the quotes in the Reuters piece, I really loved. There was a consultant who's been involved with, you know, who's involved with dealing with these types of requests for big companies, and he said, "quote I've never seen anything like this, and most companies have unreported breaches since then, and so the idea that most places have been breached, to you and I, you know, people in the industry, totally seems reasonable. Everyone gets roamed all the time. Everybody covers it up. That's the kind of normal way things go. But to open this can of worms and collect all of that information, and then the SEC will have to figure out what to do with it, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. There's going to be a reading room at the SEC, basically stuffed with interns going through incident response reports.
Yeah, it's going to be a great time. And you know, we've often talked about how difficult it is to get good data about what's really going on in this industry, and because, you know, no one wants to talk about anything. You know, maybe this will be a big enough sample set that we can actually draw some conclusions. So I, for one, say big old thumbs up to the SEC and good luck with the, you know, warehouse you're going to need to store all the documentation you get.
I blame Tom Uren because he wrote in our newsletter that, you know, it'd be good to see some more transparency around this sort of stuff. And there you go, Tom, you got your wish. Only took a couple of weeks. What do we got here? Epic. APIK, this is, of course, the hosting company that has a long association with fascist causes and sort of alt-right websites and social media platforms and whatnot. They're, you know, they are the host of choice for that sort of stuff. Looks like they got owned pretty hard. There was a bit of chatter on Twitter, but since then a few journalists have kind of run with the story, and it looks like, yeah, it's legit. A bunch of media outlets now have copies of the data, and look, you know, it's going to drive some interesting headlines, I think, when we're going to see information about, like, who's paying the hosting bills for some of this stuff. I think a lot of people aligned with fascist and alt-right causes are about to get doxxed.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, this is, you know, it certainly looks like a pretty old school sort of ownage. Like, it feels like some, you know, pretty classic politically motivated, you know, old school black hat hackers doing their thing. They dropped a nice, you know, text file with ASCII art and stuff that, you know, made me feel nostalgic for the old days. But yeah,
it looks like they did it under the banner of Anonymous, but like, that doesn't mean anything.
No, of course
not. For those following at home.
They have really gone to town. Like, there was something like 130 whatever gig in the torrent that they published, and there's data with, you know, all the things that investigators and, you know, people doing open source intelligence are going to care about, you know, like domain purchases and domain transfers and who is history and changes to DNS records and email forwards. And so all that kind of really nitty gritty technical data that is going to provide great attribution for people who are hiding their stuff behind the services provided by this network operator, and then of course also, you know, payment data, which is a great way to tie activities back into the real world and identities and that sort of thing, plus, you know, key material and passwords and you know, just all the sorts of things you want to use to go to town. So yeah, they are going to have a real bad day, and as you know, everybody that's been relying on them as being one of the, you know, safe spaces to host all your Snowflake content, gonna have a bad time.
It'll be interesting to see what comes of this, right? Because you just have a feeling that this is the sort of stuff that people are going to just wind up. It's Multigo fuel. It's meat for the Multigo machine to chew on, basically. So yeah, a whole bunch of people updating a whole bunch of org charts is my guess here. I'd be surprised if, like, agencies like ASIO here, which says now that alt-right terrorist actions, or terrorist plots are taking up 50% of its domestic CT efforts these days. I'd be surprised if they weren't taking a look at this as well. Now, this next story, I'm not sure that I'm on board with the headline. It was written
I laughed.
It was written by Dina Temple-Raston at The Record, and it says, report, Beijing, Moscow step up efforts to control the internet's backbone, when really you read the report and it looks more like China and Russia are building a lot of undersea cables in their region. That was my read.
Yeah, so the report wrings its hands about, you know, the fact that if you build the undersea cables or you control the landing sites for undersea cables, perhaps you can intercept the traffic that goes across them, which, like, yes,
so, I mean,
yes,
clearly, clearly, we should all just let America build the cables.
It's like, mm-hmm, yes, yes, you can do that. You mean like we have been doing on every cable that we have built in the history of time, or indeed sometimes other people's cables as well. So, yeah, this did seem like the sort of thing that, you know, when the Chinese protest that, you know, the West's being hypocritical about, you know, Chinese hacking or whatever, it's like, this is the sort of thing that they will point to and say, like, you know, we're just doing the things that you do. And look, you write headlines saying that we're horrible. I was like, mm-hmm, yep.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, right? The framing on this one is a little bit funny, but the story itself does cover some stuff that's pretty interesting, because there are undoubtedly security implications involved when you're carrying large volumes of data, you know, sometimes important data, over cables that are operated by a country that might not have your best interests at heart, Adam. And, you know, I've linked through to that one. I've also linked through to a piece from the Guardian, which is a three-year-old article, which was about how the Solomon Islands, which is very close to Australia, they granted permission for Huawei to land a undersea cable there. And basically the Australian government came in and urged them not to do that and is now co-funding a undersea cable for the Solomon Islands, right? So this whole thing around, like, undersea cable politics and sovereignty and whatnot, like, this is a thing. But it is the internet. It tends to terminate, you know, these cables don't terminate in the same country, all right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in the context of the wider Chinese Belt and Road, I mean, this is, you know, we're seeing this repeated across all sorts of classes of infrastructure, you know, subsea cables, mobile infrastructure, you know, satellite stuff, you know, actual roads, you know, all of the other bits and pieces that, you know, China is focusing on, you know, buying access into all sorts of places around the world in a number of means. And yeah, just one of them.
Ah, now the new OWASP Top 10 is out, Adam. And it's, look, what I love about the OWASP Top 10 is every few years they update it and it's actually interesting, right? Like, it is legit interesting to see what makes the cut. And number one on the OWASP Top 10 now is broken access control, which in some ways is like, oh my God, really? But in another way, in other ways, it's like, well, it's nice to see that, like, SQLi isn't top of the list anymore, right? It's signs of progress.
Yeah, it is always a really interesting list and, you know, super relevant. You know, web application pen testing is the bread and butter of most pen test shops. So for us, you know, this is a thing that we, you know, we follow with some level of interest. And yeah, the fact that broken access control has moved up to number one, not at all surprising. I think that tracks with the sorts of things that we see as well. I mean, the move towards API-driven web applications, you know, with multiple front ends like a mobile app or, you know, React.js kind of, you know,
well, I mean, we were just talking about a Azure case where you just drop the authentication header and you get root, basically. So,
yeah. So, I mean, that sort of thing, because we've moved to a more API-centric model, you know, is absolutely reflected in what we see. So, not surprised about that. I was surprised, like, the sensitive data exposure turned into cryptographic failures and now is number two. And that didn't really ring so true for me in terms of what we see in our output.
No, and there was another funny one I wanted to point out as well, which is they sort of grumbled a bit about having to put SSRF on the list because they're like, we're not seeing it in our data, but, you know, practitioners are telling us it's a thing. And it's like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely,
yeah, I mean,
a thing.
That was certainly one of the things I was surprised to see SSRF so far down the list.
Yeah.
I think you're right that, you know, the fact that injection bugs have dropped off number one, you know, cross-site scripting or SQL injection or LDAP injection, whatever else, the fact that dropped down is a sign that modern frameworks are better at handling that than they used to be.
Well, and also they've expanded the definition of injection to, as you say, include things like cross-site scripting, right? So it's a bigger category, whereas they used to be individual things on the list.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, that really does point to my my only real criticism of the changes this year is that, like, if you look at the history of the OS top 10 going back to, like, you know, 2004 or 2007, back then it was a list of quite prescriptive, like, here are specific bugs that every web app developer should know about and be able to say that they are not doing or that they've got some, you know, mitigation for. And
now it's a little more bit, yeah, and more, it's a bit general, more like a management pamphlet, right?
Yeah, well, now, I mean, a bunch of this stuff is no longer quite so specific and actionable. If you say to a developer, do you understand how not to do security misconfiguration?
Yeah.
Right, that's a, you know, that's much harder for them versus...
But come on, man, that's just an evolution of the discipline, surely.
Yeah, it is, it is. But I just, I mean, in terms of a, you know, it used to be 10 years ago, you could say it is reasonable for us to expect that a modern web developer should understand all of the OS top 10 and be able to explain why they're not doing them. Yeah. Right, whereas now... You couldn't give them the 2021 list and have that same expectation. And yes, that's because the discipline's matured, but how we use the list has changed a bit over time, you know, and it's a bit more taxonomic and a little less practitioner, you know, prescriptive. Which,
that's true, yeah. But I just think there are a lot more web developers now, web app developers who actually understand what cross-site scripting is, for example, right? So maybe it's, I don't know, man. Look, I see what you're saying. I do.
Yeah, I mean, it is good that it's broader because there are, you know, whole classes of stuff, you know, that was difficult to explain in terms of the OWASP top 10, which now we can. So, I mean, that generality goes both ways. But it's just, yeah, in terms of a thing that you can, you know, point to a company and say, your developers, you know, go get some training that addresses these 10 things, right? Yeah. That was an easier sell then than it is now.
Yeah, whereas, you know, go learn how to build access control, right? Which is a pretty big
topic. It's a much broader thing rather than...
I'm with you.
Yeah.
What do we got here? Olympus, the camera maker, I guess you'd still call them, but they do more than that, of course. Their Japanese servers have been ransomwared by Black Matter. A few countries, doesn't look like the United States offices have been affected, which brings us to this... interesting discussion, right? The Chris Inglis, who's the National Cyber Director in the United States, says that it's too early to see if Russian ransomware has stopped targeting America. So he's like, oh, they've gone cold and it's just too soon. Whereas the, you know, an FBI official appeared on a panel this week and said there is absolutely no indication that Russia has cracked down on ransomware gangs. So, you know, I think everyone's just taking a stab in the dark at the moment. And we're going to know a lot more when it's not holiday season in Russia anymore.
Yeah, and everyone's back from the Black Sea, then we'll see. But, I mean, certainly the idea that it would just magically stop because, you know...
Because Biden said some words,
some geopolitical stuff happened because Biden says so. Like, that doesn't seem super likely. And we've seen even, you know, some ransomware crews taking, like, specific... you know, throwing specific barbs at Biden as a result of that. So I'm, you know, I feel like the FBI guy's idea that there's been no change rings a little more true with me than, you know, the fact that we've kind of, you know, warded them off through, you know, thoughts and prayers, which...
Yeah. Agreed. Tim Starks at Cyberscoop has a write-up on a different ransomware crew, a new one called Groove, which is apparently made up like largely of disgruntled former staff members from other crews, right? Which is like, yeah, it's funny. It's industry politics that just read like any other industry politics, yeah, exactly, which is quite funny. Yeah. What else have we got? Yeah, South Africa having a hard time as well. There's been a ransomware attack that has affected some bail services, so that's less than ideal. That was, of course, we've seen other stuff in South Africa, like a port was affected a few months ago. Puma, the sportswear company, they got owned. This is one from Catalan. And they didn't get ransomware, but someone stole their source code for an internal application and is trying to do the data blackmail thing. This is a perfect example of why I don't think this is going to be a particularly useful crime type, Adam, because I don't think anyone at Puma is going to give two shits about their internal application being dropped on a dark web portal. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, because like the screenshot of the source code that they've stolen so far is like Jenkins and JBoss and Kibana and Log Analyzer, which is to say open source software that they happen to be running. So yeah, I don't know that anyone's going to pay serious Bitcoin money, you know, to get their configuration of internal monitoring stuff.
Here's $200,000. Please don't expose our Jenkins config. Like it just doesn't... I just can't see it, you know.
Dear. Yeah, so there's no like shoe source code or anything, you know, that might be worth money in the sneaker market or something. But I don't think you're going to get rich off this one, whichever crime crew did this.
A very short story by Tonya Riley over at CyberScoop. Apparently WhatsApp is going to add like properly encrypted backups to its service, which, you know, I'm guessing law enforcement have been enjoying access to WhatsApp backups. So that could be kind of a bummer for them, but not exactly sure what it means. But it does look like they're going E2EE for backups.
Yeah, and this will have the sort of natural consequence of these things, which means now law enforcement need more, you know, client-side, you know, Android and iOS ODAI to be able to monitor things at the edge instead of in the middle of the network. So,
and as we already discussed, ODAI is getting harder. Although, look, I did speak to someone in that sort of exploit dev world not so long ago, and they did say something quite funny, which is like everyone acts like, you know, once we get to the point that ODAI is prohibitively hard and expensive, that governments are just going to go, oh, well, throw their hands up in the air and go, guess we don't need that access anymore. That ain't going to happen. So no,
exactly right.
You know, but we've been waiting for that crunch time to come, and it's taken, to be honest, longer than I expected. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
let's see what happens. What else have we got? Fortinet has put out a somewhat spooky warning, Adam.
So Fortinet put out a blog post saying, maybe change a bunch of your passwords on your VPNs. Turns out that somebody, you know, when there was a bunch of Fortinet SSL VPN device bugs in 2019, someone went around and stole passwords from all of them, or, you know, many, many of them on the internet, and has been holding on to them and is now starting to sell them off.
Like a squirrel stashing food for the winter.
Exactly. And so even if you've patched your Fortinets on time, which of course lots of people don't, if you didn't also roll all your credentials, then you may well be in trouble. And yeah, Fortinet's telling everybody to roll their creds. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great example of, you know, if you have a bug and you can use it early, then, you know, you can perhaps survive the patching, come back later, sell it later. Like that, I mean, that idea that you could take one bug for one product, collect all of the key material or passwords from all of them on the internet, you know, in the first 24 hours after the patch is dropped, and then keep that for later and sell it. Like, that's a great monetization strategy.
I mean, even in the Hafnium thing, they were dropping web shells. They were just a bit too noisy about it, right? But this is owning stuff at scale 101, which is to, or, you know, on an IIS server, the old trick used to be just copy cmd.exe into a web accessible directory and then you've got shell.
You can come back later, yeah. So no, I mean, it's certainly a strategy that we've seen people use to great effect in the past, but you know, I think
it's all feeling really 90s lately, though. Like, you've got to admit, right? Like, it is. Everyone's back on the patch panic treadmill. You've got, like, this from Fortinet.
Black Hat just, stuff, some Hack the Planet. You know, it's all good times.
Yeah, there has been some Hack the Planet with the Epic thing. We're not really going to have time to talk about this, unfortunately, but I'm going to leave the link into the show notes. The Daily Swig reports that New York State has had some, you know, problems implementing its vaccine passport system. You know, this is not unique. Everywhere where we're seeing people trying to do, like, electronic passes for, you know, COVID-19 vaccination status certificates, they're not really doing it that well. This is something that I'm guessing will be gradually ironed out. But I also think one thing missing from a lot of the discussion around this is that if you start forging, certainly in Australia, if you start forging vaccination certificates, that's actually pretty serious. Like, when you start forging government documents. So I'd guess that we're going to see a few people actually charged with that sort of stuff. And that's what's going to be what prevents misuse as much as, you know, people creating secure apps.
Yeah, like, I think we forget as nerds sometimes that this is not just a technical thing. Like, I mean, there may be technical bugs and how these, you know, vaccine, proof of vaccine things work. Like, there was this guy in Hanoi who they have QR codes there to prove that you have vaccine, and those QR codes are RSA signed, so they can verify them in the field without internet connectivity, which is a great idea, except that whichever bit of the Vietnamese government that built it used 512-bit keys. And so this guy factors the keys and makes some fake QR codes, you know, for lulz on the Twitter, posts on his Medium. I'm pretty sure he is now in some pretty big trouble. His Medium post's gone because, yeah, doesn't matter that it's technical, you know, 512-bit RSA nerding. This is just, you know, if you're going to forge official government documents, you're going to have a bad time, regardless of whether you do it with a photocopier or with a, you know, EC2 instance.
I know a guy who created fake number plates for a crappy old car he had that no way was it going to pass a roadworthy inspection to be registered. So he just made some plates. And when he got caught, he got charged with fraud. So that's just something to keep in mind, right? Like, this stuff can be a little bit more serious than people realize. So anyway, before we finish up, I just wanted to I wanted to do a shout out, actually, to Ken Tsang. Now, Ken is the creator of COVID Near Me, COVID19nearme.com.au. And what he's effectively done is built a better COVID-19 vaccination booking system than any government agency or any like healthcare startup has actually managed to do. He's helped several hundred thousand people book their vaccinations through this system. And I just think it's great. And I actually noticed when I was reading the reporting about what he's done, I clicked through to his Twitter. It turns out he's a follower. I sent him a message and it turns out he's a podcast listener. So yeah, just wanted to make sure that we send an extra special shout out to Ken Tsang. And also, like, can a government, one of the state governments, the federal government, who've been shoveling money at people to do this stuff badly, maybe you want to give this guy a grant or something, you know, because what he's built, it's really quite something.
Yeah, it's always amazing what, you know, one nerd that really understands how things work can get done, you know, and you can look at that, you know, look at that and compare to what we see come out of government agencies all over the place. Like, yeah, it's... Like, how hard is it to have competent people that understand how data works and how systems work and can build computers?
I've linked through to Ken's Medium post about like why he chose to build it. But and when we say nerd, Ken, we mean that as high praise, believe me. So well done to you. And Adam, that is actually it for the week's security news. Big thanks to you for that. And we're going to do it all again next week.
We certainly will, Pat, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Fayaz Rajpari from Gigamon. Fayaz is Gigamon's security product manager and is here to talk about what they've been doing to their NDR product, their network detection and response product. And yeah, this interview, it's not too pitchy. It's just like a solid chat about what they've done and why. And I think, you know, listening to this, we can learn a bit about the way the whole NDR slash EDR slash XDR thing is playing out. Basically, we're starting to see stuff like CrowdStrike integrations in NDR products. Well, that's what Fayaz is going to talk about. And, you know, they make sense, actually, for a bunch of reasons. Anyway, I'll drop you into the interview now. This is Fayaz Rajpari from Gigamon.
Like, if you kind of think about, like, what an integration really means, then typically you kind of think about, like, yeah, just bring in logs and then we can do something with it. But typically, you know, as you kind of security organizations are looking to understand integrations and do more with them, it's more about, you know, the visibility in general and like hooking in directly into APIs, right? So what we want to do is kind of take an approach of actually hooking into, say like CrowdStrike, like CrowdStrike's integration, it was essentially hooking into those APIs and getting those detections and getting the actual host relevant details directly, intimately from those agents specifically, and then also taking like actions, right? So if the main, our main portal is a visibility portal for network detection and response. Well, what if an analyst needs to just you know, single-click contain a host and they have the relevant details from CrowdStrike and an RNDR solution and essentially want to just immediately...
Okay, okay. You know, so I think I'm with you now, right? Which is when you're scrolling through all of the NDR stuff, you see something funny, you can start performing actions on the relevant host straight exactly. From the console. Yeah. CrowdStrike have done a good job of making their stuff play nice with other tools. I think it's going to serve them well in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. I think it will too.
So, I mean, is this a trend that you're going to see across the industry, do you think? Because it really does feel like, you know, there's a lot of vendors hyping up this XDR thing, right? Which is trying to unify all manner of logs into one thing instead of it just being focused on network or just being focused on endpoint. It does feel like at this point, that's a trend that will inevitably sort of head towards completion. I'm sure you agree with that.
I totally agree, right? If you kind of think about, you know, where it's headed and like the days of been in this industry for quite a long time. And essentially in the beginning, it was like EPP or endpoint protection meets EDR, right? And now it's basically EDR meets NDR. And then going a bit further, they're also meeting the SIM and the UBA space, who essentially is what is XDR, right? It's kind of like that triad, the SOC visibility triad is what you call it, right? It's like, you know, how do you combine all forces and get the full visibility from network detection and response to endpoint detection and response, and also combining the capabilities of like next-gen SIEMs and the UEBA providers and giving that full visibility to the security analyst?
I mean, you're covering an awful lot with those three things, right? Like, and, yeah. And if anything, like we have seen some really good point solutions. I remember like years ago, Rapid7 was way ahead with their UEBA stuff. Was it called like User Insight, right? Like that thing was super useful. That. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and then you'd have point providers, like even you want to go back 20 years, you had stuff like, what was Ron Gula's one? Dragon IDS, right? Like all the way back then. And I think they did actually have an endpoint agent as well. But, you know, this being 20 years ago, it was all kind of janky and the detections weren't really that reliable and there were false positives. It just feels like we're finally executing on stuff from 20 years ago, but doing it in a way that doesn't suck.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's funny that you mentioned those things too, right? Because like, if you think about it, like I think the main difference back then was that we kind of had the concepts down, but it was very focused on like still detections or the alarms, right? Like combining detections and alarms. And now the difference has become, how do you combine that, but then also bring in the aspects of just monitoring, like video recording. Like how do you take all the video recording of everything and bringing it all together with the detections and then really making it something, right?
Well, that's the thing, because things back then weren't built with the workflows, right? So you would just assume that you would be put in a position where you would have to assume that when a signature fired, it was genuine. And then everyone would come up with these janky workflows to figure out the false positives. And now I guess these platforms are all built as investigation tools, right? So the alerts are just things that trigger investigations, and now it's all, you know, it's time consuming, but at least there's workflows behind it now.
It's all about the investigations is what I say. Like I remember when I used to work at Mandiant too, right? It was all about, you know, we would talk about detections, but it came down to it's all about the investigations, right? Because that's when you really kind of understand, you know, what is occurring. And really what ends up happening is when you start to investigate, and then detections come out of the investigation. So that's really important to understand too.
Yeah. So one thing I find interesting about this though, right? Like we're talking about this concept of XDR and unifying the magical, you know, SOC triad and stuff. But like we're a long way from having everything kind of in one pane of glass, right? So you look at Microsoft with Sentinel and Google with Chronicle. Everyone's trying to push this cloud SIEM thing, which is really cool. But I think they're a way off being able to do things like right click from the, you know, from the console for the CrowdStrike integration to do stuff on the hosts. So, I'm just guessing that it's going to be a while before you get these sort of integrations in one big tool. And we're still going to be flipping between tools for a few more years yet. Is that your feeling as well?
I think that a lot of it has to do with also like how quickly we can adapt to both the human side of things and expertise, and how quickly can we take the brains of the smart folks and then also utilize all these, you know, things like the machine learning and artificial intelligence, we call it. Can't have a show without mentioning that, right?
Yeah.
But really, I think it's really important to have kind of
you're a vendor. You've got a quota of how many times you have to say machine learning.
But I think it is important to kind of bring those aspects of how quickly can we take the human expertise and actually utilize these awesome advanced capabilities and actually start to automate. But yeah, you are right. It is going to take some time, but it's headed the right way.
So what's your vision though? I mean, as a company, I mean, your NDR platform came in essentially through the acquisition of Iceberg, right? And it was one of the early NDR products, and it was really cool because people who, you know, worked incident response designed it. And the whole idea was, you know, here is a tool that's going to be very useful in detection and response. Great stuff, right? Now you're doing this endpoint integration. It's been baked into switches, right? Through Gigamon. Like the vision there makes a lot of sense. Now, once you've done these, you know, these endpoint integrations, like, are you going to start doing SIEM integrations, or are you going to try to be the SIEM? Like, what's the, you know, as we're pushing towards this sort of unified vision, like, which way do you turn at various forks in the road? Because there's so many different ways you could go with this.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I don't envision us being the SIEM, but I do see that we're finding that the SIEM had a lot of drawbacks and effectiveness wasn't really there when it comes down to it. It was like they had, there's all these grandiose views and visions of the SIEM is going to do all these things for the SOC analyst, but turned out the effectiveness was so low. So the vision here is with the NDR solution, or specifically our NDR solution, is like, you know, we have the human expertise and we have the capabilities in our team to be able to literally, like I say, like taking the brains of the analyst, and because we have the expertise and we're hunting within our customer's environment. So why not take that level of detail that we know and actually provide predefined canned queries and investigations and really help them with their workflows and help them streamline that capability and, you know, essentially guiding them towards in the investigation. So, you know, I said it's all about the investigation, but how about guiding them towards the investigation?
Are you doing managed hunt? I didn't know you were doing that.
So we are doing I wouldn't say full managed hunt. It's a good question, right? I mean, typically like the MDR, managed detection response, does the managed hunt, but we'll kind of be that the middle ground, right? Like if you don't need the full managed hunt, and if you don't have your own expertise, or if you don't have your own, like, you know, threat hunters, we'll definitely help. We have the people and we're equipped to kind of help our customers move to the next steps of investigation for sure.
So this is the sort of thing where, because you're collecting a lot of cloud logs, you've got analysts who dive into it just kind of seeing what they can see, I guess. And then if you're spotting stuff, rolling that out as a detection, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And
you'd
be collecting a decent, I mean, you know, we did mention the machine learning words earlier. This would be a decent corpus of information that you could use to do some ML training. Is that something you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually utilize that quite a bit, and we call them observations. So the difference is, like, we don't like to, like, just kind of, you know, bubble up alerts and tell our customers, hey, go look at this, because as we all know, right, there's alert fatigue and there's all these things, and, you know, customers get really, really bogged down with that. So basically what we do is we call them observations, and our customers can look at those observations, but they're purely observations, right? They're suspicious, but we'll actually, you know, do a lot of tuning and make sure that if we're calling it an alert, it is an alert, right? So we'll kind of, that's our second or third tier of alerting mechanism, is like when they see an alert, it's actually gone through the eyes of our analysts, and now we're triggering that alert.
Now, let me guess, are you going to start pulling in UEBA information into your NDR product? Because if you're doing that with the CrowdStrike stuff, surely you'll start doing that with, you know, like user events and things like that.
Yeah, we are. And like, I want to do a lot there too, right? I think there's something to be said about identity, right? And user events and everyone knows.
Oh, because it correlates so nicely against malicious network activity. You know, if you see someone log in where they don't normally log in, and then there's a whole bunch of data flying around, like, that's a good one.
Exactly. It always comes down to, well, who is it? Who's doing this, and where is this coming from? Right. It's not about the IP, but it's more so about the machine and the user, and where is that? You know, where is this going? Right. So it all comes down to that, I would say, for sure.
So you think you'll be adding some integrations along those lines in the future?
We're definitely working that way. Yep. We're doing some interesting things for sure, and I'm looking forward to doing a lot around endpoint, more around endpoint, and also definitely more on users and identity for sure.
All right, Fayaz Rajpari, thank you so much for joining us on the show to walk through basically, yeah, just like a bit of a brain dump on what you're working on as a product manager over there for the security products at Gigamon. That was really interesting stuff, man. Thanks.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. Really glad to be on, and really happy to be on the show. Thank you very much.
That was Fayaz Rajpari from this week's sponsor, Gigamon there. And Gigamon's NDR, not trash. Do check it out. And I'll point out that CrowdStrike too, like I said nice things about CrowdStrike, they are not a Risky Biz sponsor. I think they may have sponsored like one episode years ago. So I'm not saying nice things about them because they're a sponsor or anything like that. But they do seem to be, in terms of integrations, they're doing a really good job. So, you know, credit where credit's due. Anyway, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.